it's probably about 6, 7, 8 months from now. I'll have to check. Is a dual spacecraft, two spacecrafts on a Falcon 9. They're going to launch them both to geosynchronous orbit. And the only thing, the thing that's unique about these two spacecraft, they're going to have ion engines on them, or they call them electric propulsion engines. That's the way they refer to them. But they're really ion engines. And they're going to use them for station keeping in the geosynchronous location. Some people wanted them to develop this where you could use it, you know, almost like a second stage or a third stage to actually get it to geosynchronous orbit, and they did the calculations. It would work, but the problem is it would take maybe 6 or 7 months to get to that location. And the people that are paying for these flights, sometimes in countries or wherever they are, Thailand or wherever they, you know, they don't want to wait 6 or 7 months to do it, but they're willing to have the ion engines put on board for station keeping. So when they're up there, and they're going to be doing this 15 or more year service, for instance, they want to move one, they want to relocate one to a different location in the geosynchronous orbit.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What type of orbit they're in. But if they want to move them around, they're going to use these ion engines. Back to your WS twin.
That's a very efficient way of doing it, Paul. Because ordinarily, your geosynchronous orbit spacecraft has a lot of consumable station-keeping fuel on board, which is fired for use in the reaction control jets. And as you run out of that fuel, your spacecraft becomes a hazard to everybody else. Therefore, if you follow all the rules, first of all, you pay a fine if you don't stay within your 1 cubic mile that's your address in geosynchronous orbit. Each of those spacecraft in geosynchronous orbit are like a bunch of beads on a string. Each one is a very specific spot, and you're not supposed to go out of that spot by more than your cubic mile, or is it cubic kilometer, I'm not sure which. But you have to, let me drop. You have to very carefully keep track of all your reaction control fuel. And as you get down to the bottom, let's say at the 90% consumption point, you have to use your remaining control, reaction control fuel, to blast yourself into a higher orbit, which is the graveyard. And that way you're out of harm's way for all the other spacecraft. Once you've got an ion engine, rather than have 5 or 10 years of life of your craft in geosynchronous orbit, I can see the possibility, if the ion engine hangs in there, you can have a hell of a lot more life, because now you're just taking electrical power you gather by your solar cells, and that's the major component giving you the thrust of that ionic engine. You're only using a small amount of xenon fuel, and so putting enough xenon fuel in there for the ionic engine to work for 15 to 20 years sounds to me very possible. I can also see why you're not going to bring a spacecraft up there by ionic engine, because when you're doing it with a high power thrust engine like these chemical engines or solid rocket boosters, you literally blast yourself straight into the address, if you know what I mean. You just pop right into the place where you're supposed to be. If you're doing it with an ionic engine, because the thrust is so small, you have to do it with a very gradual, expanding, spiral path. As you're slowly expanding that spiral path to get up to your particular geosynchronous altitude, let me drop. Your particular geosynchronous altitude and your particular address, and you're getting there by way of a very gentle spiral. That means near the end of that mission, of that launch, you're traversing every other spacecraft that's in geosynchronous orbit. And Murphy's Law dictates you're going to hit one of them, and it's going to make people very unhappy. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good, Dick. And I was looking for through my notes here, trying to figure out which flight that was. How many months away from now? But I can't find it. But it's not the one coming up. It's not the MUROS one. That's the one that's got to be launched for the Navy. You know, that's the mobile user objective system. They call that the MUOS. Now that'll have the regular Centaur up the stage rocket, you know, putting that into its location. That's the heavy one. I would imagine. Well, you know, I don't know what the weight is of the other two that Falcon 9 is going to be putting up, but I'm sure that collectively they're a lot smaller than this. I mean, first of all, there's two different satellites, but it's the first time they're going to be using the ion propulsion to, you know, for this purpose. It's pretty good technology that's been developed over the years, starting off with the smart spacecraft and now Dawn, which is going into orbit of Cirrus this March. So with the Psionic engine, they're coming a long way. Japan has launched one that's on the way to an asteroid, Hayabusa 2. Ion engines are the way to go for a lot of purposes. Yeah, but getting it off the ground, yeah, if you just put it on the launch pad and lit one off, you could just watch it flame out for the next 10 years. Back to you, Dick.
And you get a very nice test of the ionic engine, but you don't get any energy out of it. If it's not moving something at some number of meters per second, then all the thrust you've got is not doing you any good. Now, you did mention earlier, Paul, that people are making proposals that on a three-stage booster system to put something in geosynchronous orbit, they're in the talking stage of recovering all three stages. I'm skeptical of that. I think that third stage, you do not recover it for two reasons. Number one, in some cases, it's nothing but a simple solid-state motor called an apogee kick motor. It doesn't have any real value. You don't want to bring it back. But except for the fact that it's a lighter payload you're bringing back because you're no longer bringing back the main spacecraft. Let me drop. Except for that factor, you'll notice that everything that's in synchronous orbit, we always blast it to a higher orbit that is the graveyard of synchronous orbit spacecraft. Always up. The reason for that, you take any of those spacecraft that are in geosynchronous orbit and you decide you want to bring them home, the amount of power you put into those three stages, the amount of energy you put into those three stages to get it there is the exact same amount of energy you've got to expend to get it back down to Earth. A very slight difference. That last little bit of bringing it back down, you do hit the atmosphere and you get some atmospheric drag. So that amount of reverse thrust is not required. However, that atmosphere is only 6 or 10 miles up. Geosynchronous orbit is 22,300 miles. So I said to bring something back down from geosynchronous orbit takes almost the same energy as it took to put it there. As such, I can't see how you're ever going to have enough energy left to bring something back home from geosynchronous orbit. WS2N, KQLAW.
No, not from geosynchronous orbit, but what I'm trying to get at is SpaceX's plan is to bring, the goal is to bring the Falcon 9 rocket back. That's number one, which they're getting close now. I wouldn't be surprised if they successfully do it at the end of the month. But if you took three Falcon 9 rockets and put them together, they call that the Falcon 9 Heavy, or they call it the, you know, they just write it up as the Falcon Heavy. So what that is each one has 9 Merlin rockets on it. So you got three of these boosters attached together. The goal is to bring those three back, and that, I mean, this might be years away before they ever get that far. I mean, they do have a test coming up in the middle of the year, but that's just to launch this thing, not to bring the boosters back, but somewhere down the road, their next heavy flight would be scheduled for early next year. Who knows, they might try it then. That's considered like two stages, center stage and the outer stage is burned. The center stage burns not 100%. When the two stages that are attached to it burn out, they separate, theoretically come back and land back at Launch Complex 13. And, or eventually back on land in California, Vandenberg, they do launch from there.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
There's another stage that's attached. Let's call that the second stage. And their plan is, and it's really another Merlin engine, but it's vacuum capable. A little different than the original one. Set up to operate in a vacuum. Their long-term plans are eventually to be able to bring that one back as well. So, not necessarily a kick motor that might be attached to the spacecraft itself. That brings it up to actual geosynchronous orbit. But this other thing, they're a long way off. I mean, it will be in orbit. The second stage, this vacuum Merlin engine. Imagine this thing going 17,500 miles an hour in orbit, not geo orbit, in a low Earth orbit. Trying to bring this thing back, it needs a heat shield, and it needs enough fuel on board to. He wants to bring everything back propulsion wise. No parachutes. By the way, they tried all this with parachutes. They experimented there with parachutes years ago to bring these boosters back, and they scrapped that idea. It just wasn't practical from what I read. That's what they want to do, bring everything back propulsion-wise. It's an amazing feat. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of the first stage of a three-stage rocket booster to put something in geo orbit, because it burns out when that stage is essentially suborbital, it's going to naturally come back, and getting that is easy, or it's very close to suborbital, or it's such a low orbit that the atmospheric drag is going to bring it home pretty soon. However, by the time you get up to the velocity and altitude of your second stage, and because of the Oberth concept, where you're already up to a very high altitude and a very high velocity, every pound of thrust you're getting out of the engine at that time is giving you huge advantage in boosting kinetic energy and momentum. To not use that fuel on board completely on that second stage, to save some of that fuel, so that now, as far as the boosting function is concerned, that excess fuel was dead weight and lowered the overall efficiency. Because of the inefficiency of not burning that second stage all the way, I'm having a little bit of trouble believing that you can economically justify retro boosting the second stage and bringing it back home for reuse. The only advantage I can see of doing that is to make sure that, is to make sure you get it out of space so it's not a hazardous material for other spacecraft on the way up or on the way down. So, recovering the first stage, I have no trouble with that. But in a GEO launch, recovering the third stage, I'm positive is out of the question. And I'm right now not so sure about the economics of recovering the second stage and trying to reuse it. Over to you, Paul, KQLAW.
There was a good video that SpaceX came out with a couple of years ago. I wonder if that's still online somewhere. And it showed all this, this whole theory, the animation, and very well done, of course. And it showed the boosters coming back. It showed that second stage after it disconnects from the spacecraft turning around in space, firing its retro rockets, slowing itself down heat shield, and eventually coming back and landing on the ground with rocket power. Pretty impressive. I mean, this is his long-term goal. His goal is to bring everything back, including the spacecraft, of course, which he does now. Right now, he's got parachutes and he lands them in the water. His goal is to have propulsion. 8 Super Draco engines attached to the Dragon spacecraft, providing, I think each engine provides 16,000 pounds of thrust. A tremendous amount of thrust. And they're all, you know, variable. They'll ignite, and he's got to figure out where he can burn out 2 of these engines and it would still work. Bring it, you know, instead of 8, he'll be able to come back with 6. I mean, it looks good on paper. NASA's not too crazy about the idea from what I read. He wants to bring crewed people, you know, people, astronauts back like this. NASA wants them to use parachutes and then bring it back to land, but instead of the water. But, I mean, his long-term goal is maybe privately, you know, send spacecraft up, bring all the boosters back, bring the second stage back, and bring the Dragon spacecraft back with a crew with propulsion. You know, he's got something called the Dragon Lab, and he plans on eventually going to another space station called the Bigelow Space Station. But that'll be private, so maybe, you know, he'll get the okay to bring his crews back that way. Somewhere down the road, maybe NASA will say, okay, we'll allow this now. You know, you've made 20 landings with a crew on board. I suspect that's the way it's going to go, providing there's no accidents or anything. Interesting. I mean, this guy is really, he's really out there. He's fringe back here.
There's quite a few proposals along these lines, Paul. We're in the beginning, on paper or even with a nice YouTube video. You can make it look attractive. But when you get down to really calculating what's going on, it might not be cost-effective. There have been proposals, for instance, that we're going to mine the stuff that's on the moon, or we're going to mine the stuff that's in asteroids. When you look at the number of dollars it takes to get each pound of stuff into orbit, and then to get something down to the moon, the cost of getting your craft there is so high that I don't care what you're recovering as a mineral from the moon. I don't care if it's uranium, platinum, gold, whatever. It ain't cost effective. In other words, it's nice stuff, but it's in a very hard to get to place. As such, returning spacecraft from geo orbit, I'm skeptical. And I think I can see, let me drop. I can see some reasons why NASA may not be in favor. And when it comes to recovering a manned spacecraft, to have the final descent done by parachute gives you a very predictable velocity when you hit the water, or if you want to bring it back to land and the parachute is big enough, or maybe you use a little bit of a booster of some kind to do the last slowdown for the last few feet. But to do a retro burn without parachute and bring a spacecraft back down in the old-fashioned scientific way, like a rocket to the moon or whatever it was called, that 1953 sci-fi, to land with rocket power, it's got some nasty characteristics. If on the way down you're doing that rocket power slowdown just before you hit the Earth, if you get a hiccup in that rocket when you're backing down, things are going to get uncomfortable real fast. You're going to come down and hit the Earth awful hard. Somewhat like what happened on the thing that hit the barge. So there's not very much graceful recovery from that mode of failure. Over to you, Paul, K2RAW.
The study, well, we've done it many times with the Surveyor spacecraft that landed on the moon. six spacecraft that we put on the moon with 12 different people in it. You know, every one of those lems had to do the same thing, come out of orbit, you know, land on the moon. And they, you know, at least they had an out, though, you know what I mean? If they got close to the moon, they could always hit that button, the board button, and the first stage would, you know, the upper stage would separate from the landing stage on the lems. That was good. I mean, you know, safety is number one. But NASA, you know, they look the other way a lot with safety. For instance, Mercury had the ability to pull the spacecraft away from the rocket. They're going to do that with the SLS system. Saturn V had it, but Gemini didn't have it. All Gemini had was, ejection seats. Good luck, guys. Hit the button. That was a terrible idea.
You use rocket power to get down to the moon because you have no choice. There is no atmosphere there. You can't use a parachute. So if you're going to land on the surface of the moon, you're going to do it with rocket power. There's just no choice. So there you have to tolerate it. But coming back to the Earth, I can see how landing with rocket power is not going to be an easy sail with NASA. Because unless you've got another landing stage and a takeoff stage like you did with the lunar module, there is no graceful recovery if one of those rockets says, I don't feel like firing today. I mean, on the ground with one of your rockets doesn't fire, you just abort the takeoff. You don't release the chocks that are holding it down. But on every spacecraft that takes off from a launch pad these days, you have this great big clamp holding it down until you confirm by all your telemetry that every one of those rockets is firing and every one of them is giving you the exact same amount of thrust that you desire. And then at the last sentence, if you've got some solids that are being added to your liquids, then you fire the solids because you don't have the ability to turn them off. And you believe that they're high in reliability. So on takeoff, you can tolerate a liquid engine failure. On landing by engines, I don't think you can tolerate that, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
I know. From what I read, NASA's thinking about it. I mean, you know, they're giving SpaceX billions of dollars. Same thing for Boeing. Boeing is definitely going to come back with parachutes. They're going to land on the land. SpaceX wants their Crew Dragon spacecraft to be reusable. Now, I've read that NASA wants at least, you know, the early flights and probably maybe forever. They don't want reusable. In other words, you come back, you build a new spacecraft. That's going to defeat Elon Musk's idea of reusability with that spacecraft. But, you know, like I said, he's got plans in the future to do private missions. They'll have that capability where the government can't stop. Well, we'll see. You know, as long as accidents are avoided and, you know, everybody will push the limit. Now, what are you going to do? Dick, back to you. Anybody else have any questions or anything? I just want to give you an update on Voyager 1. It's now 130 AU astronomical units. And one piece of space ham related information is that there's only one person on board out of six on the International Space Station. That's a ham right now. And that's the Italian lady. First time you had a...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
And she happens to be the only ham on board right now. Back to you, Dick.
To your knowledge, Paul, what's the maximum number of hams we've ever had on the International Space Station? Two or three?
You probably had all six at one time. You know, I mean, for a long time, everybody that was going up had their license. The Russians, everybody, you know. So, I guess they've cut back on that. I think Scott Kelly has a M license. He's the guy that's going to be going up for one whole year starting this March with his Russian counterpart. Hope they both have M licenses. I'll have to check. Back to you.
Isn't Scott Kelly the guy that was up for like half a year once before?
Yeah, I think I just... he's done EVAs. He's gone up a couple of times. And he's got a brother, Mike. Mike and Mark. Mark Kelly. And they're both astronauts. So, Mark's, he quit. He's retired. But this guy didn't. He's no kid now. I think he's like 50 years old or something. He's getting up there. But he's going to put himself up there for a whole year. That's pretty cool, huh? Russians have done it a couple of times, but first time for the Americans.
And you do get a lot of bone mass loss in weightlessness, even if you do a whole lot of exercise and eat just the right foods. And I believe the cosmonauts, when they came home after a year, I think it was like months before they were able to walk, some ridiculous length of time, before they could reacclimate to gravity. So Scott Kelly, I think, is going to have that problem. Kind of amazed that he's volunteered for this. And I guess now that the International Space Station has got so much volume and so many modules and so many entertainment items and whatever, I guess he's fairly convinced with all the people who'll be there with him, he'll have continuous amusement. So that part will be fun. But still, what it's going to do to his body is going to be darn significant as I see it. He might come home with some relatively frail bones. What do you think, Paul? K2LAW?
Yeah, they say 2% per month you lose on your bones. And then your eyes, a lot of people have had problems with their eyes. So they're going to be monitoring this guy very well, see what happens. Don't forget, after a year in flight, you're supposed to be able to, on the way to Mars, you know, land the spacecraft onto another planet, you know. Climb out of your spacesuit. Good luck with that. Even so, the gravity on Mars isn't like what it is here. It's still going to be a tough job to get out of a spacesuit and start hopping around trying to, you know, set up your living quarters, you know. Right now, as it is, they come back. You ever see the pictures of when they come back and they land in Kazakhstan? You know, they pull them out of the capsule and they lay them in these, they look like sand chairs, and the three of them. And they just hanging out there, and they wait for the mobile vehicle to show up, you know, big trailer, and they carry him in. They don't walk in. They carry him into this thing. And it's after 3 months. What are they going to do after a year, Dick?
Yep, it's going to be significant. Tell me what happens to your eyes in space. That's a new one on me, Paul. Is it something to do with the flow of the fluids in the eye? Is it something to do with the retina detached? What happens to your eye in space that's possibly detrimental? K2LAW?
Naturally, I'm not in the medical field, but it's not a glaucoma problem. So it's not, ocular pressure. You get up to 21 or something like 22, you're going to be into the glaucoma section. It's nothing to do with that, like after landing. I would think that'd be a problem, but they say your shape of your eye changes, and the ideal is to have a perfectly round eye, and I don't know, it becomes a stigmatism type of thing. So they've had many people come back and their eyes change. It's not like they go back to normal after a while. It changes. You go up without glasses, you come back with glasses. I think what they should do is send up, like a series of glasses, with these guys when they go to Mars, in case something changes. They can put them on. You know, I wouldn't want to rely on the 3D printer to print out my glasses. I don't think you can print out a clear glass. They better send all the different possible prescriptions up with them. What would they do for me? I need bifocals. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I've been wearing bifocals for a long time. I may eventually get to the point with a required trifocals. We all become presbyopic. That's a fancy way of saying your lens doesn't have as much accommodation as a youngster. Your lens is not as pliable. Either the muscles are not strong enough or the lens is not pliable. I think mostly the lens is not pliable enough. And I believe you may have had a cataract operation. Is that true, Paul?
No. Although, you know, I got one. They call it incipient, which means not changing in size. Luckily, there. But if it got worse or something, they would recommend that. I'm out there. But, you know, as you get older, you tend to get these things. So maybe when I get older yet, you know, maybe I'll get another one or something. But now, I'm good to go. You know, well, you know what it is. Any bifocals, you don't see right far, and you don't see right close up, so you see both worlds. I don't like the ones that gradually change, these prescriptions that gradually change. I tried them, and the doctor kind of like recommended against it, but I didn't want the line, you know, that line at first. And the reason he didn't recommend it, you got a bigger field of view with the system I have. Just, you know, the standard bifocal. I don't know if you came across all that, Dick. But, I mean, they're going to have to do something with the astronauts. They're going to have to do that. Here's a million different pairs of glasses, and every size you want, and, you know, we'll measure your eyesight halfway to Mars, and we'll see if it fits. You know, if you got the right number, you might need that before you take your spacecraft down to the planet.
In the case of what you're now discussing, the eye changing shape, not staying round in the prolonged weightlessness of the International Space Station, do you have reason to believe, Paul, from what you've read, that essentially every astronaut, depending on his length of exposure, gets this problem? Or does it only affect certain people? Any idea on that one, K2RIW?
I probably read it, you know, maybe 5 or 10 different times over the years. And, of course, just recently with Scott Kelly going up. And they made it seem like they said a lot of, what does that mean, a lot of? They didn't give me a percentage. So I don't know. They're going to investigate this. You know, I mean, it's a problem. And something like that, you know, the bone thing, you know, with enough exercise and everything and trying to, you know, that helps. They know by exercising 2 hours a day, and that's what they all do up there. It does help. They know all these years of experience now. There's nothing that they, you know, like, what exercise can you do for your eyes unless they're going to come up with some drops in the future, you know? NASA space drops for your eyes. Whatever it is, microgravity's definitely changing now. We're built to live in a gravitational field there.
Over the years, we've learned a lot. In the very beginning, before they sent up Ham, the monkey, and a spacecraft, they used to believe that you wouldn't be able to eat because the food would just stick in your esophagus and it wouldn't go down without gravity. They believed you wouldn't be able to digest your food because it would sit in the middle of your stomach and wouldn't touch the walls, and it would sit in the middle of your intestines and it wouldn't touch the walls. They had a whole lot of beliefs of all the things that they thought would not work in weightlessness or in microgravity, and most of those fears have gone away. But this eye detriment strikes me serious, and the bone loss and muscle mass loss. I think even with exercise, I know you lose muscle mass. I mean, I know you lose bone mass, and I think the exercise allows you to only recover a certain amount of muscle mass, but still you lose muscle mass. So for a bunch of reasons, after a year in space, I wonder how long it takes before a man, when he comes back down to Earth, that he can walk. In the case of the cosmonauts, this is probably one of the things they're not proud of, but have they ever given you a hint as to how long it takes before a man can either do assisted walking or unassisted walking after returning from a year in space? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I know, I've heard 6 weeks is average, you know, to recover. I remember when John Glenn went up, you know, that second time on the space shuttle. That was in, the late 90s. He was 70-some-odd years old, 75 or something, 77. And they didn't show him walking off, you know. And that was after, 2 week flight or something, 10 days. The shuttle comes down, they come over with this movable transport thing, and they open the door that way, and you don't see what comes out of there. I think they probably had to carry him out. I never did hear the final results on John Glenn. But, he recovered. He's walking around now. But probably, I've read 6 weeks for most people to get their Earth legs back, I guess. And as far as bone mass, I wonder if they gained the bone mass back. Is that like lost forever, Dick? I don't know. See, I'm not a medical guy. We used to have a medical doctor. He used to check in here once in a while. I don't know what happened to him. He was good. He'd answer these questions. Back to you, Dick.
I was hoping he would show up. What the body continuously does is it's always breaking down your bones on Earth, breaking down your bones and replacing them. And the rate at which it replaces and the rate at which it breaks down is an adaption process. And depending on how much stress the bone has been put under on a daily or hourly basis, the body decides how much to replace. So even though you do exercise for 2 hours a day, for 22 hours a day, those bones are not being stressed the way they would be on Earth. So you could say 2 hours a day is not enough. And even with the exercise they do, you're stressing certain bones, you're not stressing others. Guarantee under the Earth gravity, when you and I are down here, there are certain bones that get stressed every single day. And some of those bones, it would be very difficult to find an exercise that you could do in space that would be reflexing, that would be flexing those bones. And I think the body integrates how much flexing of that bone took place during the last 24 hours. So I see the possibility that the recovery of bone mass on Earth could be extremely slow and possibly not absolutely complete. I see a mechanism by which that could happen. So you're making a bit of a sacrifice when you do this. Reminds me of the sacrifice that Story Musgrove did in the case of putting eyeglasses on Hubble. He really pushed it. He came awful close to dying, in my opinion, on that recovery mission. And I think you know that he gave a speech to us at the Astronomical Society of Long Island. Very effective speech that lasted about an hour and a half. He showed us pictures and described what took place during that mission. And you could easily come to the conclusion that, he pushed it to the very edge. He went beyond the time that his portable life support system had consumables. He consumed all of those. There's a backup reserve on that. He consumed all of that. And this took place while he was entering the airlock. And he had to use the emergency holds of the airlock while the airlock was being repressurized. Otherwise, he would have been breathing his own carbon dioxide. That's when you know you're pushing it to the edge. Over your ball, KQLIW.
Yeah, I've seen him make a lot of speeches on TV, but not of course, in person, but he was good. He was really dedicated. And, he was the part of that first group, the first service mission to Hubble. There were five of them. And, but without his efforts and everybody on board, they wouldn't have turned out a great scientific piece of equipment like that. And to this day, it's still going. What was that, 1990 when it went up? And that mission was probably a year or so later. Parrot. Wow. So, and then he went up after that, too. I think I'm looking at the time. I don't know if anybody else has any comments, but the time is ticking away. You know, look at this. K2RIW, WS2R.
Yeah, you're right, Paul. It's getting later than it's ever been. Does anybody have any questions on space, on electronics, on potentiometers, on how to get rich quick? John's good at that one. Give us your call letters and name right now. K2RIW with the Tech Man. Out of curiosity, John, do you have another mailbag item that we could squeeze in? Do you have a quick mailbag item? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. I have another item. I don't know if you'd be able to have time, but let me get my notepad.
Yeah, I'm also thinking about this reverse measurement you're going to make, the double measurement direction on your piece of coax cable. If you're using instrumentation that plots relatively accurate standing wave ratio, the apparent standing wave ratio when a piece of cable is put into a short circuit is a fairly sensitive method of telling you the real insertion loss. If the cable was lossless, you would measure exactly infinity of standing wave ratio. As the cable has any insertion loss in one direction, in VisWire is a two-direction measurement, that reading comes down from infinity real fast and gives you quite a bit of resolution. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, at that, with that short length of cable, do you think that that discrepancy would be maintained and it would be accurate?
Absolutely. I personally have measured the standing wave ratio of a transmission line that was on the input end of an amplifier, and my guess is the transmission line was less than a centimeter long. There's nothing about the VisWire measurement procedure that gives a damn about the length of the cable. The VisWire measurement procedure is how much power are you issuing forward, how much power comes back to that exact same position, and what's the ratio of those two powers or the ratio of those two voltages? There's a relationship there, if you know what I mean. It doesn't give a damn about length. Whether the length is a centimeter or a mile, the philosophy of that measurement is the same. Hang in there, Paul. And John, KC2WGB, you got to keep the faith. K2RIW.
Never made any reflection coefficients on cables, you know, less than a meter long. Never had that experience. Yeah, I can see that.
So it only cares about forward and reflected power ratio. That's what VisWire is, voltage ratio. So whether that signal has been through a centimeter or a mile of cable, doesn't matter. And there's a similar measurement when you send a signal into space and you're doing spatial time domain reflectometry, which within Airborne Instruments Laboratory, that was my most famous article. Spatial time domain reflectometry was a method of measuring the reflection coefficient of the wall of an anechoic chamber. I literally was measuring the VisWire of the wall of an anechoic chamber in free space. And I was making believe that between my instrumentation in the middle of that chamber and that wall, I was making believe that that air in between was a transmission line. It was a spatial transmission line. It was beam waveguide, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, now I realize you're 100% right, because I have had on my network analyzer, I've located defective terminator, 50-ohm terminators, quality ones, that had high SWR because they were defective. So I basically the same thing.
Yeah, by the way, sorry I called you, Paul. I said Paul so much in the last week, last hour. So, whether or not you can squeeze one in 2 minutes is your choice. Give it a try.
No, absolutely not. These are not going to be 2 minute ones, but that's fun. That's an interesting point. I can't wait. Tomorrow I'll probably mount up that cable again and give that a run and see if I can make that double reflection test, that dual trip, and if I can get better readings below 0.04, I should be down near 0.02, somewhere around there. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah, I think, let's see, have I got my calculator here? I do. I'm going to do a quick calculation if I can squeeze it in, or maybe after we close down. What is the apparent standing wave ratio of a 0.04 dB insertion loss? Now, in the case of a long cable, trying to measure the insertion loss by way of VSWR is a pretty good measurement, but it's got one vulnerability. If you've got a dent in the cable somewhere along its length, such that the dent is giving you a reflection that's being added to the reflection of the short circuit you've put at the end of the cable. Now, whether that dent reflection happens to fall in phase or out of phase with the end of the cable reflection can give you some ambiguity. And correspondingly, if one of the connectors was installed in a very poor way, so that the connector to cable interface is giving you some standing wave ratio, again, that reflection can add or subtract to the thing you're trying to measure. So there is a degree of vulnerability in the VSWR method of measuring insertion loss. But as long as you know you've done a good job of installing the connectors, and as long as you know that your cable has reasonable uniformity, then as a method of measuring insertion loss, I think it can be very good. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
WHYY. Well, to prevent those errors, when I use my network analyzer, I can determine a dent in the cable versus an error at the end of the cable. I believe that was Joe in there. KC2WGB.
You've got it, Joe.
I've done those kind of measurements before, like what you're talking about, and I think that dent in the cable is a very small percentage, very, very small percentage of your basic insertion loss in the cable from what I've done. These kind of measures, because I know what you're talking about, but you have to use a good, known, good short, or open, calibrated short or open at the end of the cable to make the measure reliable.
Yeah, by my experience, you're absolutely right, Joe. One of the things that's extremely amazing in the case of hardline is the degree of dent that's required before it becomes significant in insertion loss is so bad it would scare you. You almost have the outer conductor touching the center conductor. We're down to our last 45 seconds. You guys have been listening to TechNet number 1,539. So be kind to each other, you all. We'll be back next week. And we'll teach everybody how to get rich quick with electronics, particularly radio electronics. 73, you all. KC2WGB. Put some ribbons on it, John. K2RAW listening.
KC2WGB, very good thing. Yep, want to thank everybody for participating, and hope everybody shows up next week. If everything goes right, we should be here. Right, Dick? KC2WGB, 73s, everybody.
As long as we stay healthy, and we're too ornery to get sick now, after all these years.
Gotta stay in the game or you can't get even.
The guy who dies with the most number of toys is the one who wins.
That's going to be me.
Is there anybody you know, John, who owns more test equipment as a ham radio operator within a 500-mile radius? Anybody you know who can top you in test equipment? Over to you, John. You're the man. Hang in there, John. Bye-bye for now. A chance to make that cable VSWR measurement, they'll give you a call in a couple of days. I'm kind of curious as to how it's going to turn out. Have a VSWR measuring test set, vector network analyzer, or whatever, that you trust for reasonably high accuracy of Vizwar numbers? If so, you've got it made. Got it made. Good luck with that measurement. Bye.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Next tonight at 8:30, this is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Next tonight at 8:30, WQVL Repeater System. Next tonight at 8:30, welcome to the WQVL repeater.
K2UPS mobile.
Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
2KZ, November 2, Zulu, it's N2KZ, listening. November Kilo Zulu and 2KZ in northern Stamford, Connecticut. N2KZ.
Thank you.
Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Drive today. It's less than a mile. On the winter time I drive, the summer time I walk.